Bad news? They're leaving. Going back to Paris. The entire French delegation. Didn't you fly over here with her?
I did.
And they're going home without you?
They are.
And how do you feel about that?
I don't entirely know.
You are braver than me, I muttered, even doing a pretty good imitation of Sari's accent.
She said that?
She said that.
Lulu tucked her hair behind her ear. Is it wrong if I say there's something bitchy about that? Like she's using it as an excuse? Oh, you're just braver than me.
Sari's a good person, I said, but I didn't disagree with what Lulu said, and I thought of Connor's thin line.
And how do you know when you've stepped from brave right into reckless?
When you can change into a wolf?
I dropped my head back to the seat, closed my eyes. They're going to tank the talks. If they go, there's no way we're going to get everyone together again. There's no way we're going to get peace in Europe. Right now, it seemed like even peace in Chicago was in danger. Was that why this mattered so much to me? Because my parents had managed peace here?
I'm pretty sure the talks were already tanked.
I opened my eyes, gave her a piercing look.
You know it's the truth, Lise. Murder doesn't exactly whet the appetite for peace. And now the question isn't how to get the talks moving again. It's figuring out who wanted to derail them in the first place. Who wanted to ruin what we have, to change the balance of power.
I was fired up and prepared to argue with whatever she'd said, but she was absolutely right. My job was no longer escorting the French delegates. It was figuring out who had sent the French delegates home. 20 minutes later, we pulled up in front of the Portman Grand. A knot of paparazzi waited outside, their gazes avaricious. They were waiting to question me about murder, about the peace talks' failure, and, depending on how long they'd been out here, the fact that the French delegates had taken their luggage and run. I sucked in a breath, put my hand on the car door.
I'm the brave one, I murmured, but Lulu jerked the car away from the curb before I could get out.
Nope, she said, continuing through the circular drive.
Can't do it.
Can't do what? Where are you going? I checked the side mirror, watched the possibility of a hot shower and minibar binge disappear behind me.
I'm getting you away from this hotel and all those blood-sucking reporters. No offense. You'll stay with me.
Stay with you?
In the loft. There's a second bedroom. Well, it's storage, really. And it's small. And Eleanor of Aquitaine might have peed on some stuff. I mean, I check in there and keep the door shut, but I think she does it out of spite.
She waved it away.
I'm sure it's fine. We'll just Febreze it.
I weighed cat pee against going back to Cadogan House and facing down my mother's sword again.
Actually, that would be fantastic. Good, because traffic is a bitch. Autos were supposed to clear this nightmare up, she said, laying on the horn.
What about my stuff, my luggage?
You can grab it tomorrow when the reporters have slithered back into their pits. You can borrow some stuff tonight.
I don't deserve you, I said, marveling at how generous she was being, especially after I'd been dumped by vampires, for possibly the second time this week. With a half-cocked smile, she adjusted her rearview mirror.
I'd say we probably deserve each other.
This time, I tried to pay the proper respect as soon as I walked through the front door. Hello, Eleanor of Aquitaine. She just blinked and stared, and looked generally judgmental.
I don't think she likes me.
Probably not, Lulu said, but she doesn't really like anyone.
I'm here because she allows it, and we both accept that.
She reached down,
scratched the cat between the ears. The cat leaned into her hand and made a weird little bark when Lulu stood up again.
She barks. She talks, Lulu corrected, in her own particular accent.
As if offended by the comment, Eleanor of Aquitaine trotted away, tail in the air.
Where did you get her?
Lulu walked into the loft, pulled off her jacket, tossed it onto a stool at the kitchen island.
Honest to God, she was sitting outside my door one night, just staring up at it. No tags, no collar, no microchip. Just 4 pounds of attitude and expectation.
I lifted my brows. Black cat just randomly shows up at the door of the daughter of two famous sorcerers?
She was a kitten at the time, Lulu said. And she's just a cat. She's not a sorceress in disguise, or a familiar, or shifter, or whatever. She is particular, though. Keeps me on my toes. I bought her a cheap catnip toy one time, and she could tell. Left a dead mouse on the kitchen counter. Found her sitting in front of it when I got up to make coffee, like she was daring me to clean it up.
Maybe it was a gift?
She hissed when I touched it. I had to wait until she was out of the room before I tossed it.
She might be evil.
Oh, she's definitely evil.
She smiled broadly now.
That's why I respect her space and her privacy.
How much privacy does a cat need?
You'd be surprised.
She yawned, stretched her arms over her head, then swiveled side to side.
Hell of a night, Sullivan.
Yeah.
Insomnia will not be a problem tonight. Let's go take a look.
At the cat pee room?
At the cat pee room.
We passed a bedroom and surprisingly large bathroom and reached a closed door on the back side of the loft, farthest from the windows. So far, so good. She opened the door, flipped on the light.
Ta-da!
She said weakly. It was a decently sized room, maybe 10 feet by 12, but it looked like the set of a horror movie, right before things go bad. There was a 4-foot-high ceramic clown and a headless male mannequin wearing a pair of lacy underwear. Lulu rounded out the collection with some kind of taxidermied albino rodent and a long board punched with dozens of rusty nails. But the nightstand and bookshelf were fine.
Sidewalk finds for future art projects, she said, dragging the clown toward the back wall.
Then she put her hands on her hips, looked around.
At least it doesn't smell like cat pee, she said brightly.
No, it doesn't. But I eyed the mannequin warily.
His name is Steve.
Where would you suggest I sleep? And that's not sarcasm. She wheeled the mannequin to one side. The wheels made a rusty, grinding noise Eli Roth probably would have appreciated. Then she pulled down a panel of wooden slats that hung on the side wall. I'd thought it was an art piece, but it descended to the floor, making a neat platform bed.
Murphy bed, I said. That's handy. I had a roommate for a few months. It didn't take.
What was wrong with her?
She was chipper. I don't mind laughing, appreciate quality sarcasm, but she thought the world was a happy and wonderful place.
And you know better?
Parts of the world are great, parts of the world are garbage. I can't abide optimism.
I pointed down. Those are Snoopy sheets.
Snoopy was a realist. Much respect for Snoopy. Woodstock was the asshole.
I had no response to that.
You still a t-shirt sleeper? She asked.
Yeah. She gestured me to follow her, and we walked to the other bedroom. Unlike the rest of the space, it was nearly colorless. The walls were pale gray, and there was a low platform bed, the bedspread white with dots of a slightly paler gray. A nightstand held a wind-up clock, water glass, and magazine. The only thing on the walls was a large painting of the curvy women I realized was her signature style, this time in shades of white, black, and gray. "Very different look in here," I said. "Needed to be quiet when I sleep, loud when I'm awake." She slipped around the bed to a gray chest of drawers, pulled one open. She pulled a bright pink Magnificent Mile t-shirt from a drawer and tossed it to me. The tags were still attached. "Haven't gotten around to wearing this yet?" I asked, holding it up by the little plastic tie. She shrugged. "It was in a gift bag, I think, from some deal my mom talked at." I walked to the painted canvas. Up close, I could see textures in the paint, ridges from the brush strokes, a grid from some sort of plastic embedded in the acrylic, tiny spikes I really wanted to test with a fingertip. But I knew better than to smear my fingerprints all over her work. "I like the layers in this one," I said. "You're really good." "I'm determined," she said. "I think sometimes that's more important. Just putting a little bit out there every day. You do the work or you don't. The externalities don't really matter." She yawned. "The fight wore me out. I'm going to crash hard. I'll be around tomorrow. I have a commission to finish up before I can go back to the mural. It's for the Near North Library branch."
"You're famous."
"In a very different way than I figured," she said gravely. "Anyway, I'll be around."
I nodded.
"I'll probably go to Cadogan tomorrow. Tell them about the French houses if they haven't already heard. See if they've got any more information."
"And you're cool with doing that on your own? I mean, you're welcome to be my sidekick anytime. But yeah, I can manage. You have a painting to finish."
She seemed relieved.
"If you learn anything, let me know."
"I will." I walked to the doorway, Eleanor of Aquitaine moving into the bedroom as I headed into the hall.
"I really appreciate this, Lulu."
"Damn right you do."
16. I was not murdered in my sleep. I couldn't be sure Steve hadn't moved in the night. Had he been turned toward the bed? But he hadn't pushed me into the loft to face the sun, so I wouldn't complain. I got dressed and found Lulu with arms and legs akimbo on the bed, her hair spread like a dark halo. I considered waking her up, but figured she could use the rest. She'd fought hard. And then there was her guard. Eleanor of Aquitaine eyed me suspiciously from the end of the bed.
"We don't have to be friends," I whispered. "It's good enough that you're a friend of hers."
One tail swish, then she closed her eyes. I guess I'd gotten all the time and attention she'd been willing to give. I took an auto back to the hotel, jumped out half a block before the entrance, and slid into the lobby before the paparazzi realized who I was. I showered and changed clothes, pulling on a green V-neck t-shirt, skinny jeans, and boots, and repacked my one and only suitcase again. 20 minutes later, I was in another auto, headed to Cadogan House. I'd done the right thing, asked my parents and Theo to meet me at the house to discuss what had happened the night before, what we'd learned from it, and why I hadn't violated the ombuds deal. It was going to be ugly all around. I'd left the hotel early, hoping I could get some time with my parents to warn them about my theory. They'd be angry enough about the fairy visit. Telling them I didn't consider myself a Cadogan novitiate wasn't going to help things.
"It can't be helped," I murmured, trying to reassure myself.
"Please repeat command," the auto said, in a stiff female voice that tried to thread the needle between comforting and authoritative. I didn't give a command. I was having an emotion out loud.
"Increase motion sensitivity?"
"No, do not increase motion sensitivity." I didn't even know what that was. but approved autos weren't all created equal.
Continue to destination, please.
Continuing to destination.
I thought about applauding her, but didn't want to risk it.
The house was quiet. There were vampires in the foyer and front parlor, whispering as I walked through. They smiled or offered nods, but didn't speak. I could feel the egregore as I got closer to my father's office, and knew my mother's sword was there. The monster called to it, trying to push through me to move closer to the magic contained there. When I stepped into the doorway, the throbbing of power was nearly loud enough to drown out my heartbeat. It doesn't matter, I told myself. It can't matter. My mother leaned over the conference table, and a spread of paper, katana belted at her side over jeans and a black top. My father was at his desk in his typical suit. Hey, she said, standing straight. The word was an echo behind the pulse of magic, and I made myself concentrate on the lingering buzz of power my parents put into the room, which was lighter and brighter than the swords. The monster wasn't interested in that, so it receded. For now. I was just looking over the proposed security updates, she said, but her smile faded as she squinted, looked at my face. What happened? She strode toward me, steel in her eyes. Not just my mother, but Sentinel of Cadogan House. My father frowned and moved around his desk. What happened to your face? My face? When he reached me, he brushed fingers over my cheek. Damn. The bruise hadn't faded completely, and I'd totally forgotten about it. We'll get to that. He arched an eyebrow. Will we? There was a knock at the threshold. Theo stood in the doorway, Yoon behind him. Yoon wore a dark suit, Theo jeans and a fitted button-down shirt in a pale blue gingham. I gave Theo a hard look. He was supposed to show up alone, then report back to the ombuds and save me the trouble of having to face them directly. And I still hadn't briefed my father. I opened my mouth to ask them to give us a minute, but Yoon strode inside with fury etched into his face. Ruudon called the ombudsman's office, he said, settling angry eyes on my father. Complained that Elisa visited them, attacked, instigated violence among the fairies. My first reaction was fury at the lie, but my father's gaze, cold and icy, kept me silent, and the seconds that elapsed while he turned that gaze on me seemed to take a lifetime. Are you out of your mind? His words were chilly and as sharp as his gaze. It wasn't the first time that I'd angered him, and might not be the last, but even at 23, I didn't care for the feeling. Then Gabriel stepped into the room, Connor behind him. And she was joined by Connor Keen, Yoon said. I guess we've come at just the right moment, Gabriel said, but my father's eyes stayed on me. We didn't attack the fairies, I said. Lulu and I went to the castle to talk to them. Just to talk. I pointed to the fading bruise on my face. They took a different position. Why did you need to talk to the fairies? My mother's eyes had silvered with emotion. Because of this. I pulled out the handkerchief and the pin and handed them to my father. His eyes widened. Fairy maid? Of course he'd know that, I thought ruefully, wishing I'd shown it to him first. As it turns out, I said, then pulled out my screen and showed him the still I'd saved yesterday. Worn by a fairy at the reception. I found it near the patio after we talked yesterday. My father's expression didn't change as he tucked the handkerchief away, handed the pin to Yoon. But my mother's went thoughtful. You inspected the crime scene. Sentinel, my father warned, probably detecting the hint of approval in her voice.
"Yes," I said, looking back at him. "I found it, and we found the fairy wearing it in the video."
"And you didn't report this because..."
"I didn't know if it had anything to do with the murder. He could have been at the party as a guest, and it happened to fall off. We wanted to see if it meant anything first."
I glanced at Yoon. "Especially if the Ombudsman's office already thinks Riley's guilty."
"We decided we'd ask them about it," I continued. "So we drove out there. And they were... less than accommodating."
My mother snorted a laugh, then covered her mouth at my father's glower.
"Sorry, inappropriate. That was just such a Sullivan thing to say."
The glower deepened.
"Sentinel."
"And so is that," she said, and made an effort at a serious face.
"They attacked you," my father said, looking at me again.
"Yeah. We didn't see Claudia, but Ruidon was there."
"What instigated the violence?"
Yoon asked.
"They're sociopaths,"
Connor said dryly.
"They were fine at first," I said. "Ruidon seemed interested that we were there. But we asked about Tomas, if they had any information about his death. It went downhill from there. I asked about the pin, and they attacked."
"They attacked you?"
Yoon asked.
"They made the first move. Lulu and I defended."
"Lulu?" my mother asked.
"Wakizashi," I said. "Catcher trained her."
"Of course he did." I could tell she wanted to ask more, probably about her skills, the dance of the battle, and how I'd handled myself, but she managed to hold her tongue.
"We fought," I said, "and we were outnumbered. And then Connor showed up."
"That's awfully coincidental," my mother said, glancing at him.
"Right place, right time," Connor said.
My mother looked dubious, but didn't object.
"You could have been killed."
I looked at my father.
"I'm fine, but Riley's in a cage."
"You were given express instructions not to interfere with this investigation."
We all looked at Yoon. The anger or frustration he'd been holding in had apparently boiled over. I'd figured him for calm and collected, at least in comparison to Dearborn. But there was no calm in his eyes right now.
"We didn't interfere with your investigation," I said. "You weren't investigating the fairies because you've already decided Riley's guilty. We've found a new suspect."
Yoon stepped forward.
"That is beside the point. You violated Cadogan's contract with the city. Penalties will be assessed, financially and legally."
Damn it. There was no way to avoid this now. No time to prepare my father.
"The deal doesn't apply to me."
"As a member of Cadogan House..."
"I'm not a member of Cadogan House,"
I interrupted, and steeled myself, made myself look at my father. "I'm the daughter of its master, but I'm not a novitiate. I was never initiated or commended. I'm not a member of any particular house. That makes me a rogue, and rogues didn't sign the deal." The room went absolutely silent, and my father's expression went absolutely blank, and a little bit lost. My heart clenched uncomfortably. Gabriel walked to Yoon, put a hand on his shoulder.
"I'm going to get some coffee, and you're going to go with me."
He all but pushed Yoon out of the room. Connor and Theo followed, Connor giving me a supportive nod over his shoulder. They closed the door and left us in silence. It was a full minute before my father spoke.
"You are as much a member of this house as anyone ever has been or will be," he said, and I could plainly see the hurt in his eyes.
"I'm sorry," I said. "I wanted to talk to you about this before I said anything, but there hasn't been time." "Cadogan House is my family," I said,
wanting to take a step toward him but not sure if that was the right thing to do. It always has been. I didn't grow up feeling excluded. That would have been impossible in a house that had basically adopted me as its mascot.
But you weren't commended, he said. Not officially. And you consider yourself a rogue.
I don't consider myself anything, I said, not realizing it until the words were out. Maybe that's why I'd felt such a strong kinship with Maison Dumas, because I hadn't had the same connection to Cadogan, at least not like my parents had. And maybe that's one of the reasons Sari and Marion's leaving had hurt so much, because Dumas had been my house as much as any other. But when it had been time to run, they'd left me here.
I'm not sure I agree with your argument, my father said, but there's no precedent to measure our behavior against. You were the first child. The canon had nothing to offer.
The canon was the collection of vampire laws.
But if you're right, he continued, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that we didn't think to make it official.
His voice was colder now, controlled in a way that only a master with experience could manage. He stood apart from us, and my mother looked between us with concern, trying not to take sides. I didn't feel excluded, I said again. It was the only thing I could think to say. And in this particular situation, it's handy. My father nodded.
Tell them we're done here, will you? And ready to discuss the rest of it.
I nodded, knowing I'd been dismissed, and left my parents alone, with a cold ball in my stomach.
She's right, my father said when the others were back in the room.
Theo came in with coffee, offered me a cup, but my appetite, even for caffeine, was gone. Connor watched me carefully, as if trying to gauge how the talk had gone. I didn't meet his eyes. I wasn't ready to dive into those feelings.
She wasn't initiated into the house or commended, and the canon doesn't provide for membership based solely on a genetic or familial relationship. That's a technicality, Yoon said.
No, my father said. It's a contract. If you want to enforce the deal so carefully negotiated according to its terms, then you have to adhere to those terms.
I thought I saw appreciation in Yoon's eyes.
This isn't you, Yoon, my father continued, his voice softer now. I'm sure Dearborn is angry, but you know better. Could I trouble you for a drink?
Yoon asked after a moment, and my father smiled.
That bad, is it? Dearborn's pissed, Theo said as my father went to the bar, poured two fingers of scotch, neat, into a chubby glass, then offered it to Yoon.
Yoon sipped, lifted his brows.
Very nice. Very old, my father said. And it does the job.
Yoon nodded.
Dearborn is furious. He had convinced the mayor the peace talks were his idea rather than yours, he said, looking at my parents. He cares less about their effectiveness in reducing violence than the political reward of hosting a well-received event in Chicago. He's a player, Gabriel said, or imagines himself to be one. Yes, Ruidon's call was routed first to him, and his displeasure was passed to the rest of us, with orders to fix the situation immediately. With your magic wand? Gabriel asked with a smirk. Something like that. I suspect he wants Riley locked away, literally and figuratively, so he can assure the mayor and the rest of the delegates that Tomas's death was an unfortunate act by a lone wolf, pun intended, that won't affect the talks going forward.
Yoon looked at Gabriel.
He'll use Riley as a scapegoat if he can, even if that means the rest of you go down too.
Alaska cannot come soon enough, Gabriel muttered, but the fury in his eyes belied his casual tone. I'd put their trip out of my mind, but was disappointed to remember it now. Not just because Connor had helped us last night, but because it seemed like we were starting to interact like adults. We're putting aside our history. We were becoming friends, or something like it.
My hands are tied, Yoon said, as are those of Cadogan House.
He shifted his gaze to me.
But perhaps Elisa has some flexibility. If you want to secure Riley's release, you'll need evidence, solid evidence, that he's not involved.
I smiled thinly. Then let's get to business. We sent the reception video footage to Kelly, asked her to run the ferry's image against the house's surveillance video of the party. While that was underway, we talked through the visit to the castle again to see if there was anything we'd missed. We didn't come up with anything new, but I did wonder about the effect of our visit. I looked at Yoon. You said Ruidon called you? Why not Claudia? He blinked.
I presumed she delegated the task to him. He's younger, more comfortable with technology. Claudia wasn't in the gatehouse, Connor said. Maybe Ruidon was handling the matter himself under her orders, so it was his duty to complain. He frowned. But it didn't have that feeling. Like he was there solely to protect her interests.
It didn't, I agreed. It felt like he was playing king.
And perhaps the phone call was another example of that?
Yoon asked, nodding.
That's a possibility. He might have designs on the throne. Fading magic, Gabriel said, and we all looked at him. Ruidon is young. He was born after the Egregore. Fairies have been powerful his entire life, and that's changing now.
He lifted a shoulder.
Maybe he's angry about that process and blames Claudia for it.
What could she have done differently? My mother asked.
That's the question, isn't it? Gabriel said. Possibly nothing. But maybe Ruidon has other ideas.
They let us leave, I said. At least in part because they didn't want to incite the pack's wrath. But I don't think that was all of it. I think they have something else planned. And it must have something to do with the talks, right? That's when all this started. Maybe the question isn't who killed Tomas. It's who wants the peace talks interrupted, and to breach the peace in Chicago in the process.
And why?
Yoon said, then glanced at my parents.
You've had experience with the fairies. We hired them, my father said. They were called mercenary fairies then, because that's how they presented themselves. They were skilled and merciless and available for hire. They guarded the house during daylight hours, when we were asleep, for many years, until they turned their weapons against us. They are capricious. And as the mercenary moniker should have warned me, they were, apparently, available to the highest bidder.
The Greenwich Presidium, my mother said. Cadogan House held an artifact Claudia wanted. They turned on us to obtain it. Gold and jewels are especially alluring.
They don't believe in romantic love, my father said. But Claudia had an apparently meaningful relationship with what we'd have called a demon, and she was the one who told us about the spread of Sorcha's power across Chicago. Her behaviors are inconsistent, Yoon said. Externally, yes, my father said. But internally, they're entirely consistent. She is the center, always. She wanted coin, so she offered the fairies to the house as security. She wanted the jewel, so she offered her services to the GP instead.
And then there was the Greenland, my mother said, reaching out to take my father's hand. She breathed in slowly,
as if preparing herself, and then looked at Yoon. Before they lost their power, the fairies lived in what they called Evan Ablach, the Greenland. They came to Chicago but retained their connection to that realm. When Claudia came to Cadogan House to talk to us about Sorcha, she made the green land. She made a waving motion. Sweep over us. It was a beautiful place. Hilly and green and cool. We could smell the ocean on the breeze, hear the grass rustling. And there was a little girl. She looked at me. This wasn't long before we got pregnant, but it hadn't happened yet, and we didn't know if it would ever happen. Her gaze lost focus as she walked through the memory. We heard this laugh, a child's laugh, but there was no one around. No parent she might have belonged to, except for us. I don't know how we knew it, but we knew she was ours. Her voice softened to a whisper. In that moment, there was absolute happiness. It was only for a moment. Claudia brought us back here. Or maybe it's more accurate to say the Greenland was taken away from us. The sense of loss was devastating. It felt like we'd lost her for real. She looked at me again. It hurt to come back, to leave that and her behind, especially when we didn't fully trust the prophecy. What if that had been our only chance with her, with you? She breathed out heavily through pursed lips, obviously working to control her emotions. I'm here, I said, and smiled. I know. And we're glad. Usually. She added with a grin, her way of diffusing the emotion in the room. I guess the point is, the Greenland is a powerful place for fairies. I don't know if they were able to increase their connection to it after Sorcha, when their power was stronger. But either way, I'd bet their connection is less now. She looked at Yoon. Maybe that's what this is all about. Thinking political power is how they obtain the magic they need. Unclear, he said. But the more information we have, the better chance we can deal with them before they get out of hand. Or further out of hand. Maybe insinuating themselves into the peace talks is an effort to get the power they need. I looked at my father. You heard about the French delegation?
What about them? Yoon asked. Chevalier and Dumas went back to Paris near dawn, my father said.
Good, I thought. At least they'd done him the courtesy of telling him directly. What did Seraphine have to say about this? My mother asked, frowning as she walked to me, then took my hand. That the talks had been disrupted and there wasn't a reasonable chance they'd work, so Marion and Victor voted to go home and deal with the problems on the ground. I'm sorry, my mother said. I'm so sorry they left the way they did. I believe I'd take that very personally. It's hard not to, I admitted. But Lulu's letting me stay at her loft, so that helps. My mother smiled. I left Mallory's to come here, and now Lulu's taking you home to her place. That seems about right.
There will be no talks without France, Yoon said.
I told Sari that. She was apologetic, but...
But they still got on the plane, Connor said.
I nodded.
The delegates from Spain left early yesterday evening. The other delegates remain in town, my father said. They opted to cancel tonight's session, given the absences, but I understand some of the delegates will be meeting together in smaller groups.
So there's still hope, my mother said.
Fading hope, he said. I don't blame Spain, and I don't blame France. I don't know who to blame.
He looked at me.
But the fairies seem to be at the top of that list.
The room got quiet, all of us probably wondering what would happen next. You should find Claudia, I said to Yoon.
Claudia?
Either she's directing Ruidan, so this is her fault, or she doesn't know what he's doing and she needs to. She has to be the key here.
Yoon looked at Theo and me. Go back to the castle and demand to talk to Claudia. Tell them you're there on behalf of the Ombudsman, and you have CPD support. Take a couple of officers with you if you need to, but talk to her.
Theo nodded.
And Dearborn? He might see you're communicating with the fairies, because it's inconsistent with Riley's guilt, as a rejection of his authority. So you can say no to the task, and I won't hold it against you. No, I'll go, Theo said enthusiastically. Dearborn can shove his authority up his pompous ass.
Oh, I like him, my mother murmured. I'll go with you, I said. You don't want to go in there alone. I looked at my parents, tried to reassure them with a glance that I could handle myself. My mother nodded back. I might have been her child, but I was an immortal and I was strong, and they'd have to let me take my chances. I looked at my father, and his expression was still carefully blank. He was very good at that. I chalked it up to 400 years of experience.
We'll focus on the peace talks, he said. Try to keep the remaining delegates in the country. Perhaps they would be amenable to discussions here.
The ballroom, my mother said with a nod.
It's a good thought, presuming we can keep the fairies out.
My father's voice was dry.
We will keep the fairies out.
He glanced at Yoon.
And we'll advise you of the results of the video search. Then I'll leave you to it, Yoon said, glancing between me and Theo. Be careful out there, and report in frequently. Will do, boss.
He looked at me.
You ready?
I glanced at my parents, then back at Theo. Can you give me a few minutes?
Sure, I'll be outside. Head out when you're done.
And he looked back at the door.
Okay if I grab something from the kitchen?
Go for it, I said. In the time we made those arrangements, my father was gone, leaving my mother and me alone in his office. He went to talk to Kelly, my mother said. I think he needed a few minutes. I nodded.
You could have handled it better, she said. You could have talked to him first.
I meant to. I was going to. Yoon got her earlier than I thought he would. Or the auto had gotten me here later. But really, neither of those mattered. It was my doing, my fault for not taking him aside first.
You're right, I said. I should have. And the thought that I'd hurt him curled my stomach again.
Should I talk to him about it?
Why don't you give him a little time? She suggested. This isn't just about Cadogan House, but about his being your father. He'll be hurt that you didn't talk to him, and guilty that he failed you by not making you a full member.
He didn't fail me. But he'll think he did, she said, not unkindly. He loves you, and he loves this house. And your being part of the house, that's important to him too.
I nodded, feeling miserable and hating that there was no quick fix for it.
She put an arm around my shoulders.
You've had a hard homecoming. I'm glad Lulu's there for you, and that Connor was there.
Not for long. He's taking the pack to Alaska.
I know. How do you feel about that?
I gave her a narrow-eyed stare.
What do you mean, how do I feel about it?
She just looked at me for a moment.
How do you feel about his leaving? She finally asked. You've been spending more time together since you've gotten back, and he helped you out last night.
Leaving is what he has to do, I said, not comfortable digging into my feelings about Connor any more than that. They were complicated, and he was leaving anyway, so they hardly mattered.
The pack has been planning this for a while.
She nodded. I'll talk to your father. And when things have calmed, you should talk to him too. Apologize. I would, as soon as possible, because walking around with a belly full of guilt was going to get very old, very fast. Be careful tonight, she said, wrapping her arms tightly around me before I could respond. We both want to handcuff you to Cadogan House, keep you safe, but that wouldn't do anyone any good. She pulled back, brushed fingers against my cheek. We are very proud of who you've become, but never forget where you came from. With those words in my head, I walked back through the house, found Connor waiting outside, one leg slung over Thelma. His arms were crossed, and there was a very serious expression on his face. What's wrong? I asked. Nothing. He uncrossed his arms. I've got work to do for Alaska, but I wanted to talk to you first. I didn't like the second mention of Alaska, but still didn't want to think about it. I wanted to talk to you too. About last night, I'm sorry about the attitude. You were trying to help, and I wasn't ready to hear it. He looked back at me, brows lifted. Is Elisa Sullivan, the bossiest of the bossy, apologizing to me? I'm not bossy. I'm decisive. At that, Connor rolled his eyes. But yes, I'm apologizing. I know you were trying to help, and I appreciate that you're on my side. It's just hard to take advice after dealing with this for a long time on my own. I'm sure it is. The bigger point still stands. You don't have to deal with it alone. I didn't believe that for a second, especially since he was the only person who knew the truth and he was leaving, but I could appreciate that he cared. Thanks. Listen, Lise. Theo seems like a good guy, but the fairies are dangerous. He'll be there on behalf of the Ombudsman, I said. They may not respect me or Lulu, but I imagine they'll think twice before going up against the entire city. And Theo? My brows lifted. What about him? He looked at me quietly for a moment. Can he handle himself? Given the pause, I wasn't sure that was the question Connor really wanted to ask, and it occurred to me, maybe a little late, that I didn't actually know the answer. Surely Yoon wouldn't send Theo to the castle if he couldn't handle it. I settled on, we'll find out. That's not a very good answer. It's the only one I can give you. We have to go to the castle because we don't have any better options. Riley's still behind bars, and my parents' house is being used to further someone's violent agenda. I gave him a half-hearted smile. Don't worry, you won't have to rescue me again. I didn't mind rescuing you the first time, he said, and there was something different in his eyes, emotion I hadn't seen before and wasn't entirely sure what to do with. But you don't really need rescuing, Lise. You just need a good partner. I wasn't prepared for the intensity of his gaze, and my instinct was to turn away, to put space between us that would give me time to think. You don't need rules for this, Connor said, and grabbed my hand before I could turn. I looked back at him, watched his eyes darken like storm clouds over a cold, deep sea, his gaze so intense he might have seen through to my soul, and felt the sudden, wild hunger that rose up in response to it. Connor watched my face, thumbs stroking the sensitive skin on the inside of my wrist. Magic pulsed in the air, and it had nothing to do with my monster or the fairies. It was shifter magic. Wild and rough and barely tamed. And it was vampire magic, dark and careful and dangerous. When he finally released my hand, which prickled from the residual magic, The intensity in his eyes had changed, evolved into satisfaction at whatever he'd seen in my eyes, or the pounding pulse he'd have felt in my wrist. It took a full minute to find my voice again. "I have to go." Connor looked at me quietly for a moment, and this time his face was unreadable.
"Be careful."
I nodded and stepped back, then watched him pull on his helmet and start the bike with a roar of engine and exhaust. And then he drove off into darkness. 17. It was a balmy night, and although Theo wore short sleeves, the air conditioning in his vehicle, a former auto with zero waste and ombudsman stickers on it, was turned up to Arctic levels. "Warm, are you?" I asked him, climbing inside.
"Sorry," he said, and turned it down. "I'm from Texas. Hard habit to break. Everything all right back there? With you and Connor, I mean."
"There isn't a me and Connor, so yeah, everything's fine." Wanting to change the subject and get this particular show on the road, I glanced at him. He looked cool and collected, if excited. "If things get bad in there, you can handle yourself?"
"I don't have your blade training, but yeah."
He lifted up the hem of his shirt, showing the gun holstered at his waist.
"I was with the CPD before I joined the ombudsman's office. I'm a certified marksman."
I blinked. "What? How old are you?" He smiled.
26. I've been shooting since I was 10. My parents thought it was weird, but I was good, so they dealt with it."
"And why the switch to the ombuds office?"
"You ever read comics?"
"Not really."
"Being a human, supernaturals are kind of other. We didn't really have access to them. The houses aren't zoos. So you make assumptions. Immortality, magic, strength. Comics, graphic novels, are how we know about those concepts. That's how I got interested. I started as an intern, then worked the reception desk when Marge decided to retire."
"And do you still think we're superheroes?" He grinned.
"Most of the time, you're a little more Bruce Wayne than Batman. But the lure's still there."
I tilted my head at him. "You looking to join a house?"
"No, my ma's religious, and that would pretty much kill her."
"Huh.
Yeah, she's old school, despite my efforts to the contrary."
"There's only so much you can do." We drove to the castle and parked outside, found the gate open again. The castle was dark, and the neighborhood was silent but for the whistle of a train in the distance.
"It's quiet,"
Theo said, pulling out his weapon, turning off the safety, and checking the chamber. When he was satisfied, he holstered it again. I belted on my katana.
"It was quiet last night, too," I said, and we stepped through the gate, walked in moonlight toward the gatehouse. "But not this quiet."
One of the doors was open several inches. Theo looked inside, then pushed it open all the way. The gatehouse was empty, the room lit only by the shaft of moonlight. Even the torches were gone, their holders empty.
"The torches were lit last night," I whispered. "This is where they met us."
"You didn't go any farther?"
"No."
Theo nodded, pulled out his screen, began taking photos. I walked to the doors that led into the courtyard and pushed. I expected them to be barred from the inside, for the gatehouse's emptiness seemed to be a trick or a trap, so the weight nearly pulled me inside when the door swung open, revealing a wide avenue of space around the keep, which stood in the middle. There were squares of grass and stone, raised gardens filled with vegetables and flowers, planted trees, and sitting areas where the fairies might have enjoyed the weather. Like the gatehouse, everything was dark and quiet. The torches were gone, every window in the building dark,
with only the moonlight casting shadows across the stone. I took photos, then slipped back into the gatehouse.
Anything?
Theo asked. He crouched near the wall, ran a swab along the ground, then slipped it into a clear bag.
Nothing. No fairies, no lights. There are garden plots that still have food, so they didn't take everything. But they seem to be gone. What do you have there?
Fairy dust.
You're joking.
He rose, slipped the bag into his pocket.
Entirely, he said with a grin. I'm just pulling a forensic sample.
He looked up and around.
It's not often we have an opportunity to inspect a fairy house.
Glad I could help. I glanced back toward the doors. We need to check the keep.
Yeah,
he said, and followed me into the courtyard, then let out a low whistle.
This is impressive.
Yeah. The tower loomed in front of us. It was difficult to estimate stories given the irregular windows sprinkled across the front facade, but I guessed at least 4.
You want to take the building or the courtyard?
Theo asked. I'll take the keep, I said, too curious to pass up the chance to walk through the fairy's home.
You okay going alone? And I'm not saying I doubt your skills with what is probably a really sharp katana.
He cast a wary glance at the door.
I wouldn't want to go in there alone.
There's no one in there. He looked back at me.
How do you know?
Magic, I said. There was a lot more of it last night just because there were so many of them here. I wasn't sure until I walked into the courtyard. But they're gone. I looked up at the tower. I mean, still creepy. Still possibly haunted and booby-trapped. But I can deal with that. I dealt with worse monsters.
Here,
he said, and pulled a small flashlight from his pocket, then checked the time on his screen.
20 minutes. You aren't back by then, I'm coming to find you. And don't make me do that.
I'll do my best. I checked the time, then flicked on the light and headed toward the keep. Theo didn't need to know my hands were sweating. The doors were unlocked. I pushed one open, slipped the flashlight into the gap, and spun the beam around the space. No movement, no sound, no fairies. So I slipped inside but froze just inside the door in case of a booby trap. Once again, there was only silence. The room was tall, 2 stories of stone, the walls covered in embroidered tapestries, the windows covered by long velvet curtains. There were alcoves on both sides of the room, stairs disappearing as they curved upward. There were woven rugs on the floor, a long table in the center of the room flanked by benches, and an enormous fireplace with a hearth that was nearly 10 feet long. At the other end was an ornate throne in a gorgeously carved and gleaming wood. This was probably the central gathering room, the place where the fairies ate and socialized and took their instructions from Claudia. But there was no sign of the fairies now, only the things they'd left behind. That included a fine layer of dust that had settled sometime within the last 24 hours, probably stirred up when they'd gathered their belongings and left the property. And it smelled green, like asparagus and freshly cut grass just beginning to decay. I flipped a mental coin and took the staircase on the right, a spiral of stone steps cantilevered into the wall. No rails, no banisters. I kept a hand on the stone and stayed as close to the wall as possible, then made my way up to the 2nd floor. A passageway curved away from the stairs, and I stepped through and into a narrow hall with several doors on one side and windows on the other. The window glass was wavy and bubbled, and I figured that was an artistic choice to better match the medieval feel of the place. They looked over the courtyard, and I watched Theo's flashlight bob here and there as he searched it. The doors were open to small bedrooms that weren't unlike the dorms at Cadogan House. More gorgeous wooden furniture, including several beds with posts carved into climbing vines and flowers. Very